It is Monday, January the 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Coming up, the Iran nuclear deal implemented. We'll look at why Tehran is doing this.
Their top priority is not to support Hezbollah or Hamas. Their top priority is to save Iran.
Also ahead, finding a cure for Ebola, which has killed thousands in West Africa. We'll have the latest from the world of social media, plus some good times for country music makers. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Over the weekend, the International Atomic Energy Agency certified that Iran met the provisions of the nuclear deal crafted by world powers, a move that cleared the way for Tehran to get relief from crippling international nuclear-related sanctions. For some perspective on all of this, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with Portland State University Middle East scholar Peter Bechtol, who says the deal is a good one for all parties, including the U.S., Iran, and the whole of the Middle East. He says it's good for world peace as well because he feels endless confrontation doesn't work.
The first thing that always comes to my mind, and something I continue to teach at the university, is that international relations always has a domestic component to it. In this case, both in Iran and in the United States, there are hardliners in Iran, there's a moderate president, and the supreme guide, Grand Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has to balance the two. Similar in the United States, as we all know, we have an administration that at the top very much believes in diplomacy rather than brute force in dealing with Iran and some other countries. And we have an opposition, especially among people running for the White House later this year, who seem to be much more hawkish.
The removal of sanctions gives Iran access to funds ranging from $50 to $100 billion, according to senior administration officials. Are you concerned that they may turn this into its terrorist proxies?
I really don't think so. We have to remember several things here, Victor, and you may know about all these. And that is that the accord that leads to the removal of sanctions, partial sanctions actually, was approved not just by the United States. This was not bilateral. It included Britain, France, Germany, China, and Russia. And all of these countries have a stake in fighting against terrorism because all of them have, in one way or another, to deal with this. The Iranian economy has been hurting under the sanctions, and there are some who argue that the increase in sanctions under the Obama administration has turned the screw so tightly that the Iranians were more likely to agree to the nuclear deal. That is possible. So I don't think they're going to jeopardize this. They have many, many reasons to reinvest in their own economy. I don't think they're going to use extra funds for nefarious purposes. I mean, the Iranians are not stupid. They are among the most clever people in the world, so clever that I sometimes worry about it. And their top priority is not to support Hezbollah or Hamas. Their top priority is to save Iran.
Peter, the U.S. Treasury Department on Sunday, the same time all this announcement was made, imposed new sanctions on five individuals and several companies for ties to Tehran's ballistic missile program. So we have kind of a tug of war here.
Yes, we do. And, you sort of wonder whether that is Washington politics in order to appease the critics to say, look, we have won this, but we are also giving you that on the other side, or whether it is poor timing. I sort of doubt that because I don't think the Treasury Department would do this on their own. Now, the individuals that, as I understand it, are people who were guilty of violating the Export Control Act. I see that more as a way to send a signal than to actually undermine, the agreement.
With regard to the prisoner swap, if you will, four U.S. citizens were freed by Iran in exchange for seven Iranians, according to Iranian state television, who apparently have been involved in some sort of criminal activity at one point or another. Was this an even exchange?
Well, as I understand it, and of course I don't have the passports in front of me, that all individuals on both sides had dual citizenship. At least the four that had been imprisoned in Iran had U.S. passports and Iranian passports, and they're all Iranian Americans. And the ones who are kept here in the United States, I don't know if they have U.S. passports, but they certainly had permits for living in the United States. And I think it is the kind of exchange that results from bargaining, similar to other exchanges we've had with Cuba, with the Soviet Union in the olden days. It seems to be reasonable. You know, I mean, there's great pressure on President Obama to get the journalists released, and that is fair. And there's a price to be extracted, and so the U.S. happened to have some people available and said, all right, you release them, and we will release these, because otherwise the Iranian government would be under great pressure domestically, and so they are in a position to say, yes, we let them go, even though they were guilty, in our opinion, but the Americans also let some of the people go that we wanted to be released.
That's Peter Beckhold. He is a senior adjunct professor at Portland State University, also a veteran of 30 years service in the U.S. State Department, and he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Still ahead on the program, the tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif will visit Riyadh and Tehran in a bid to mend ties between the rivals after the recent Saudi execution of prominent Shiite cleric Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr and dozens more. That led to mob attacks on Saudi Arabia's diplomatic post in Iran and the severing of ties between the two nations. For some perspective on the long-standing issues between Saudi Arabia and Iran, we turn to Carol Castiel. She is host of the VOA program, Encounter.
The latest friction comes at a key moment for both states. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani was elected in 2013 with a pledge to open up his country to the outside world, revive the economy, and pursue at least limited social reforms. Saudi Arabia's King Salman ascended to the throne just 1 year ago and has shown signs of acting in a more decisive manner than his predecessors. His boldest move has been a bombing campaign in Yemen, where Saudis and Iran are on opposite sides of that country's war. Well, with us to discuss the reasons behind and the ramifications of the widening gulf between Saudi Arabia and Iran are two distinguished regional analysts. Hussein Ibish is senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. Previously, he was a senior fellow at the American Task Force on Palestine. And Robert Wirth, he's contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Robert previously served as New York Times bureau chief in Beirut. He's the author of the forthcoming book, A Rage for Order, The Middle East in Turmoil, From Tahrir Square to ISIS. Well, Hussein Ibish, let me begin with you.
Sure.
And talking about the execution of the Shiite cleric, to what extent do you think this was motivated primarily by domestic politics, perhaps to appease hardliners in the kingdom, or to what extent was it really directed against the arch-rival Iran?
Well, I think that there is a series of messages that are being sent to different constituencies simultaneously through the execution. And it's important to contextualize it in two ways. One, as you noted, the majority of those executed, and this is the second mass execution in Saudi Arabia's contemporary history. In this case, 47 people were put to death, 43 of them being accused al-Qaeda members, Sunni extremists. Nimr al-Nimr, though, I should say, was not just an advocate for Shiite rights in Saudi Arabia and against discrimination. He was an advocate of secession. He wanted the eastern province, which is the oil-rich and Shiite-majority portion of Saudi Arabia, to actually secede from Saudi Arabia. And that's a red line that I think Saudi Arabia wanted to tell everyone is not going to be tolerated. So the message first to the domestic audiences, to the Shiites, is don't talk about secession because it really is apt to get you executed. It's that bad, especially if we think you're advocating violence, which they, I think, really do believe he was. Secondly, to Al-Qaeda extremists, you face death. The message to Iran is we're prepared to raise the stakes. We're not afraid of you, and we're willing to confront you. And if we take a decision to execute both Al-Qaeda members and dissident secessionist Shiite clerics, we'll do that, and we don't care what you say. And to the United States, it's a message that your leadership is lacking, and we're not going to ask you first. We're going to do what we need to, and we expect your support. But if we don't get it, well, that's the way it's going to go.
Turning to you, Robert Wirth, for your take on the messages sent by the execution of Nimr al-Nimr, which seems to have precipitated this series of events and the severing of diplomatic ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
I would agree with everything Hussein said. I think the Saudis feel that they cannot count on America any longer. For a very long time, they felt that their security guarantee was the United States, that they wouldn't take any major decisions without consulting the United States. And in this case, there were, I think, diplomatic signals sent from Washington. This is a bad idea. Do not execute this cleric. It's going to cause all kinds of ruckus. And they made a point of saying, no, you know, you're not our bosses in this respect. We feel that you're not protecting us. You don't have our back anymore. They felt that, as Hussein said, that the Iran deal was a very bad thing for them and for the region. They feel that it has unleashed Iran. That, in other words, that by containing Iran, at least temporarily, from a nuclear weapon, that they feel that the Iranians now feel they can do anything else in the region, including the things that most threaten the Saudis, which is, you know, all kinds of aggression in Lebanon, in Syria, where the Saudis have watched for years now as, what is it now, 300,000 people have been killed. And there is, of course, a sectarian element there as well in Syria, which is that the rebellion is essentially a Sunni rebellion against a regime that is led by Alawites. And the Saudis have watched this and felt our Sunni brothers are being slaughtered. And who is guiding the slaughter? It may be Bashar al-Assad nominally, but who's behind it? Iran. So they feel literally that they are surrounded and under siege by Iran. And I think they want to send a signal. We are not going to consult anybody about this, including the Americans. And we want to send a signal to Iran. We're not afraid of you. It's very much of a piece with a signal that the Saudis are sending with their war in Yemen. We're not scared of you.
Robert Wirth is a Middle East correspondent with the New York Times. He and Hussein Ibish, senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, speaking with Carol Castiel. She is host of our program, Encounter. You can hear more of their conversation by going to our website at voanews.com and look under the Programs tab for Encounter. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
This is VOA's International Edition. Although the Ebola epidemic in West Africa is essentially over, except for some sporadic individual cases like the recent Ebola death in Sierra Leone, which has caused the reinstitution there of another 42-day Ebola watch, research into finding a vaccine or a cure actually continues. The latest research showing that success is using antibodies to fight Ebola infections in mice. A study was done by researchers at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York and the U.S. Army Medical Institute of Infectious Diseases. They engineered antibodies to combat the two deadly strains of Ebola, the Zaire and Sudan strains. Dr. Jonathan Lai is the co-leader of the study and an associate professor of medicine at Einstein College. He speaks now with VOA's Joe DiCapua about the Ebola antibody research.
antibodies are the workhorse of the immune system. What happens is when you or anybody else gets an infection, the body produces antibodies as a way of trying to fight off the infection. So they're protein molecules that bind to the virus and either prevent the virus from infecting new cells or help clear the virus from the body. The problem with Ebola is that the virus, once it infects a host, is able to replicate very rapidly to the point where it can very quickly overtake the immune system so that the body can't produce these types of antibodies fast enough. So the idea behind antibody therapy is to give the body a chance to get a leg up on the infection by giving additional antibody.
Why focus on those two particular strains of the Ebola virus?
Really, two reasons. The first reason is because if you look at historical outbreaks from 1976 to 2012, and I don't include the 2014 and 2015 epidemic because the numbers still are being worked out in terms of the number of cases, but from 1976 to 2012 at least, the Zaire species and the Sudan species are responsible for 95% of Ebola-related deaths. In fact, before the 2014 epidemic, the largest outbreak of any Ebola virus species was actually caused by Sudan in the year 2000. So, number one, we felt that something that at least covered those two species would be a significant advance. The second reason is because those two species on the evolutionary scale are actually the furthest away from one another in terms of the properties and the amino acid alignment sequences of the glycoprotein. So we felt that if we could really bridge those two different distant species, that would be also a very good first step to be able to accomplish.
Is there a simple way to explain how you tweaked the antibodies to make them recognize and kill the Ebola virus?
Sure. So we started with two different antibodies, one that was specific for the Zaire species and one that was specific for the Sudan species. What we did was basically link the Zaire antibody with the Sudan antibody to create a two-in-one combination Zaire-Sudan antibody.
So you did this work in mice, is that correct?
Once we had produced the antibodies, we shipped them off to our collaborator, John Dye, who's at the United States Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, USAMRID. And he works in a high containment facility, a biosafety level 4 facility, which is required for these types of pathogens. And he and his team tested the efficacy in mice.
And the outcome?
In one experiment, he took mice and challenged them with the Zaire species of the virus, and then provided the combined antibody. And in a separate experiment, he took a separate batch of mice and challenged them with the Sudan Ebola virus, and then provided them with the same antibody. And what he found in both cases is that he was able to observe 100% protection. In other words, none of the mice died from the Ebola virus species in either case, whereas the control groups that did not receive the antibody treatment in both groups had all died by the 10th day.
Ask Dr. Jonathan Lai. He said the next step on the way to human studies in larger laboratory animals. He was speaking with VOA's Joe DiCapua. It is time now to look at what's happening on social media, where U.S. presidential contenders have been commenting on just about everything, including the Iran nuclear deal. Our social media guru, G. Abby Lee, is here with the word. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. Sundays are usually our quiet days, but that wasn't the case this Sunday. Presidential hopefuls had a lot to say, from the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, to criticizing other contenders in their own parties. Donald Trump called Ted Cruz a nasty guy, and Bernie Sanders defended his tax plan as being completely different from that of Hillary Clinton's. He actually argued she doesn't have a plan, but just an idea.
Speaking of ideas, I'm sure the Iran nuclear deal was high on people's agendas. Where might we go on Twitter to find out what the general sentiments are about Iran?
I would say this week ABC and The Face of the Nation are both doing pretty well at painting the general picture. The account names are also the handles without any underscores. So let's check out some of the tweets. Here's one. Hillary Clinton calls release of prisoners from Iran the kind of smart diplomacy I was proud to be part of in the Obama administration. So you can tell she's welcoming the news to a certain extent.
And what about the people who want to be the Republican Party nominee for president? What are they saying?
The GOP contenders expressed a less enthusiastic response in general. Here's what Ted Cruz said. Any nation that captures our soldiers should face serious repercussions. A lesser-known presidential hopeful, Ohio Governor John Kasich, said, I am thrilled for the families that the hostages were released. But where's the great victory here? Steve, let's check out a couple of more scathing remarks. Marco Rubio said, if you take an American hostage, Barack Obama will cut a deal with you. Donald Trump sent out this tweet. In Iran deal, we get four prisoners. They get $150 billion, seven most wanted and many off watch list. That got retweeted more than 3,500 times and liked by almost 7,000 users. That's all for me today, Steve.
And many thanks to you, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. You can find G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And International Edition's Twitter handle is at VOA _IE. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A team of astronomers suggests that some good places to look for extraterrestrial intelligent life just might be in clusters of old stars. These more ancient stars don't have as much of the heavy elements that are needed to form planets as younger stars, such as our own sun. But the researchers say exoplanets have been found orbiting stars with only a tenth of the heavy elements of the sun. They say any planet capable of supporting life that formed around these old stars would have to orbit it closely. The close orbit could protect the planet and help it survive for perhaps billions of years. The researchers theorize that any life that did develop there could have had plenty of time to evolve, become more complex, and possibly develop intelligence. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks to you for tuning in today. Well, you know, with the new year, there is new music. Of course there is, and a lot of great country music in 2015. But what's in store for the year ahead of us? International Edition's Sarah Williams talks with Nikki Strong of VOA Music about what the more anticipated country music will be for 2016.
So, Nikki, I already know we can expect a new album from the iconic Loretta Lynn. It'll be her first one in 10 years. It's called Full Circle and hits stores around March 4th. What other country legends are releasing new music?
Well, Sarah, I just found out Willie Nelson, last year's recipient of the Library of Congress's Gershwin Prize for Popular Song, will salute the brothers George and Ira with the new album. It's called Summertime. Willie Nelson sings George Gershwin. It's due out February 26th. It won't be a traditional country album, but it should be good, as Willie puts his own touch on Gershwin standards, like It Ain't Necessarily So, and they can't take that away from me. Vince Gill is another icon whose new CD, Down to My Last Bad Habit, drops February 12th. I love that title. Vince consistently produces great quality music, and we expect no different this year. The current single, Take Me Down, featuring Little Big Town, has a sultry country rock feel. He also has a new song with newcomer Cam on it, so I'm really looking forward to checking that out. And another artist coming back from a long break like Loretta Lynn is Wynonna Judd. The self-titled CD Wynonna and the Big Noise will hit February 12th. This will be Wynonna's first full-length studio album of original material since 2003.
Wow. What other country albums by women have fans abuzz?
Well, tons, actually. A couple of them, Brandi Clark. Now, she's a brutally honest songwriter whose single Girl Next Door is a great song that basically says, hey, you want the girl next door? Go next door. Girl, you want that girl? Go get her. Bye. So she really has guts and grit, and her CD is scheduled to drop in the spring. Lucinda Williams is another bold, gritty, passionate storyteller. Her CD, Ghost of Highway 20, drops February 5th. And another woman artist I am looking forward to is Aubrey Sellers' debut CD. She's the daughter of Leanne Womack and prolific songwriter Jason Sellers. But she says she has her own sound that she describes as garage country, bluegrass, and blues songs presented in a new, edgier way.
Well, let's get into the guys. What do they have in store for us?
Okay, they have lots as well. I'm looking forward to Brothers Osborne, Pawn Shop. They're very funky and gritty, and they borrow from a lot of influences, including classic rock and modern country, and they do really good stuff. Charles Kelly of the group Lady Antebellum drops his solo project while the group is on hiatus, and I have loved what I have heard from him thus far. The single Lucky Girl was written with one of the gods in country music right now, Chris Stapleton, along with Chris Fraser, and the title track The Driver is really nice too, and it's done with Dierks Bentley and Eric Pasley, and that album is due out February the 5th. Dierks Bentley, by the way, will be dropping a new album too called Black, which he says will be deeply personal. It's already available on pre-order, but no release date as of yet. And speaking of deeply personal, Blake Shelton will drop his album, and we all expect it to be about his relationship and public divorce from Miranda Lambert. Now, he says this album's going to be very personal, and I can already hear gossip sites right now just dissecting every single lyric. So,
well, thank you, Nikki, for this country music preview. You can find a more extensive list of the most anticipated country albums set to drop in 2016 on VOA Music's Facebook page or via Twitter at @VOA_music. You can also catch Nikki every week on Country Hits USA on VOA 1.
I'm going to take you for a date, take you for a ride, going to get you over there on the passenger side. I'm going to put the radio on your favorite song. I'm going to crank it on.
That's Blake Shelton right there, his new song, Gonna. Now, I got to tell you, you got to check this out on the internet. Go there and just look up Blake Shelton and the song Gonna, G-O-N-N-A. It'll be completely worth the search. I encourage you to do so. Listen, everyone, thanks for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. We hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the third Monday of each January, Americans honor the memory of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Dr. King, a Baptist minister from the southern state of Alabama, was a leader in the U.S. civil rights movement, advocating social change through nonviolent means. On January 15th, he would have celebrated his 86th birthday. Believing that change does not roll in on the wheels of inevitability, but comes through continuous struggle, Dr. King organized and participated in mass action boycotts, sit-ins, peaceful marches, and other nonviolent acts of civil disobedience. Dr. King once stated that an individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the conscience of the community over its injustice is in reality expressing the highest respect for the law. And so, activists sometimes deliberately, but peacefully and respectfully, broke laws aimed at segregating the white citizenry from the non-white, thus hoping to bring attention to the inherent unfairness of such legislation. Thus, when a black seamstress named Rosa Parks broke the law in Montgomery, Alabama, by refusing to give up her seat on a bus to a white passenger and subsequently was jailed for her transgression, her plight generated national attention and increasing sympathy for her cause across the country. Dr. King was 39 years old when he died by an assassin's bullet on April 4, 1968. But his legacy lives on. In the fullness of time, segregationist laws were repealed. Discrimination is a legally punishable and punished offense. And even as we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr.'s life and enormous contribution to society, Barack Obama, the first ever African-American U.S. president, begins his seventh year in office. I never thought in my lifetime that I would see one of us aspiring to be the head of our nation, said Martin Luther King Jr.'s eldest sister, Dr. Christine King Farris. Mr. Obama leading us toward the presidency, is like the promised land for us. Dr. King's life is well summed up in his own words. The quality, not the longevity of one's life, is what is important.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's 4.